Blog Talk Radio.
Don't you know I'm still standing better than I ever did? Looking like a true survivor, feeling like a little kid.
Good Thursday evening. It's 8 p.m. Eastern Time in the U.S., and that means it's time for Making Sense with Steve Lazor. I'm Steve Lazor, and I thank you for deciding to spend a part of your evening with me. We have a great show for you tonight. Our special topic for the evening is, who is responsible for the divisiveness in American politics today? Is it possible that one person is responsible for the genesis of nasty polemicists like Michelle Malkin, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and Ann Coulter? Could that same person be the reason we cannot resolve issues like budget disagreements and the fiscal cliff? Are they the reason we have trumped up issues like Monica Gate and Benghazi? So let's get started answering that question. I've been talking a lot since Election Day about how Republicans have stopped being Americans, that their party has become their nationality, and that they are responsible for the divisiveness in America today. I talk a lot about this issue because it has a profound effect on the reality of life and politics in America today on basically every issue from Benghazi to the fiscal cliff. So in tonight's episode, I want to devote the show to how this came about and who is responsible for it. Now, to do that, I'm going to start talking about, for instance, the latest example of Republican Party nationalism in the rants of Ann Coulter, and where Coulter's own politics have their genesis. But before I get to Coulter, let's remember where politics were only 33 years ago. If you look at politics before the 1980s, you didn't see the kind of animosity that Republicans and Democrats have for each other right now. In fact, even up until around the middle of the 1980s, you can find a lot of instances of Democrats and Republicans in the Congress working together to solve this country's problems. Doesn't that seem unbelievable now? In terms of regular folks and their friends, people could discuss politics with their family and friends without it usually interrupting into an all-out nasty battle. That seems impossible now. Sure, sometimes, you know, in the olden days, 33 years ago, you know, nasty battles happen. I mean, the old phrase, don't discuss religion or politics, predates the 1980s, to be sure, right? But in general, you didn't have the vitriol in politics that you have now and has steadily gotten worse over the last 28 years ago. Chris Matthews, the host of MSNBC's Hardball, likes to tell stories about friendly private interactions between Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, the Democratic Speaker of the House at the time. Matthews was a senior aide to Tip O'Neill, and in one story, Matthews had this to say. About this time of the year, three decades ago, Reagan went to the Capitol to deliver the State of the Union address. His designated holding room was the Speaker's ceremonial office just off the House floor. Matthews was a senior aide to the Speaker, and he thought a little kidding was in order. He said, Mr. President, welcome to the room where we plot against you. Oh, no, not after six, Reagan replied. The Speaker says that here in Washington, we're all friends after six. If you understand that, if you understand how friendly Reagan was in person to Democrats when he dealt with them, listening to some of Reagan's rants about liberals in public, the things that he said when he was interviewed on TV, takes on a different tone. Let's listen to two of those public speeches that Reagan gave.
Back in 1927, an American socialist, Norman Thomas, six times candidate for president on the Socialist Party ticket, said the American people would never vote for socialism. But he said, under the name of liberalism, the American people will adopt every fragment of a socialist program. There are many ways in which...
So that's one. Let's listen to another one right here.
Mr. President, in talking about the continuing recession tonight, you have blamed mistakes of the past, and you have blamed the Congress. Does any of the blame belong to you?
Yes, because for many years I was a Democrat.
So those are two examples of how Reagan would talk about liberals and Democrats in public.
The socialism clip, of course, that's a little bit more cutting. The other one more meant as humor. But if you understand who Reagan was from having met him in private, now I never met him in private, but I've read a lot of anecdotes. If you understand that, you get something different from what you hear listening to the public clips. Most of the country, and most importantly, most of his supporters then and now, didn't know that the attacks weren't supposed to be personal, that you were supposed to separate how you felt about the philosophy in general from the people who believe in it. From everything that I've read in private, Ronald Reagan seemed to be that kind of person. He probably always meant well. But the effect he came to have on his supporters and those who view him as the grandfather or more, we'll talk about that in a second, of their philosophy was and is something completely different. Let's get back to Ann Coulter. Coulter's latest article titled Make the Democrats Own the Obama Economy is a study not just in how modern Republicans think about politics and policy, but it also makes clear exactly what is important to them. It starts with the title, which makes the point in a fairly obvious way. Coulter thinks that Obama's ideas on the economy will be bad, and she wants the Democrats to be blamed. That's the most important thing to her. We're then hit on the head with the point, with the first sentence of her first paragraph, which reads, "One bright spot of Barack Obama's reelection was knowing that unemployment rates were about to soar for the precise groups that voted for him, young people, unskilled workers, and single women with degrees in gender studies." Now, large groups of people being unemployed is a good thing for Coulter for two reasons. First, it would achieve her political objectives, right? Her political objectives here aren't to make the country better or to make Republicans look good. It's to make President Obama and the Democrats look bad. It's more of the Mitch McConnell, our primary goal is to make Obama into a one-term president stuff, but of course the president already won re-election, so they can't hurt him anymore at the ballot box. But they can try and tarnish his presidency. This is where everything ties together. Benghazi, which I've talked about a lot, is part of that, but so is trying to make the economy as bad as possible and pin it on the president and Democrats. Now, the second objective for Coulter here in her article is that she clearly wants revenge on those groups of people because they voted for Barack Obama. Just to reiterate who those groups are, according to what Coulter wrote, it's, quote, young people, unskilled workers, and single women with degrees in gender studies, end quote. That's what Ann Coulter wrote, but we all know it's more than that, right? Barack Obama got just under 52% of the vote. The bottom line is if you voted for Barack Obama, and that's about 95% of African Americans, 80% of Asians and Jews, 75% of Latinos, 53% of all women, members of unions, etc., Ann Coulter wants you to suffer. She thinks you deserve it and would love to see it happen. Now, where did Ann Coulter learn this? And where does this divisiveness in America come from? This is the point of what I'm getting at here. Where does this divisiveness and vitriol come from? Now, a quick look at who Ann Coulter considers to be her big hero and an analysis of when America started to become a truly divided place yields the same answer on both counts. I've been talking about this on a number of appearances on radio and television. It turns out that Ann Coulter considers Ronald Reagan to be her main political hero, and it's from Reagan that she derives most of her philosophy. How else could you interpret these statements that she gave to the Washington Fancy, to whom Coulter said, quote, "I never knew Reagan personally, but what he did for the Republican Party was much like what Jesus did for the Christian faith. Who knows what other religions Jesus would have founded, and similarly, who knows what other movies, I mean political positions, Ronald would have been in, though he did leave us with a lot of movies, I mean important political history." So Coulter compares Reagan to Jesus Christ. Now, obviously, that's what he meant to her in terms of politics. Now, since that's how Coulter makes her living and what she talks about, I think my point is pretty well made here. But let's dive into that a little further by examining a couple of choice excerpts of what Coulter wrote in her column about Reagan right after he died. Coulter wrote, America's greatest president has gone home. God worked through Ronald Reagan on Earth, and now he's taken him back. Thanks to him, the United States of America never ceased to be, as Reagan said, a place to escape to, the last stand on Earth. Coulter continues with, no thanks to liberals, I might add. More enraging than their revisionist history of Reagan is liberals' revisionist history about themselves. Now liberals claim they liked Reagan at the time. This is extremely believable. Aren't we all fond of someone who regularly exposes us as liars, cowards, and hypocrites? It's just human nature, end quote. So it's hard to determine what Coulter is concentrating on more here. Is she eulogizing Reagan or bashing liberals? Or is it closer to the truth to say that the two are close to being one and the same? Because that is what Reagan's public persona was really about. He was about bashing liberals. Let's continue reading more quotes from this Coulter article. Only authentic Americans loved Reagan. Reagan forced Americans to confront the real ideological divide between conservatives and, as he said, our liberal friends. He told no jokes, though he did say some amusing things inasmuch as he was talking about our liberal friends. I could almost stop there, right? Coulter is as much as making my thesis for me. I mean, it's my contention that Ronald Reagan is the cause of the nasty divisions we have today between liberals and conservatives. And here, Coulter is basically agreeing with me on that, saying Reagan concentrated his efforts on emphasizing the differences between us. I have to wonder, is that someone Americans should be celebrating? Or is it more fitting that someone who did that be subjected to, as the Latin phrase goes, damnatio memoriae? So yeah, I could stop there, but let me read three more paragraphs from this loving eulogy of Reagan by Coulter. In the throes of the Cold War, still hot in Vietnam, Reagan forthrightly said, liberals refused to acknowledge that the choice was not between peace and war, only between fight and surrender. In words that would have come in pretty handy in Spain just a few months ago, he said, liberals tell us if we only avoid any direct confrontation with the enemy, he will forget his evil ways and learn to love us, end quote. Now, this reference to Vietnam is pretty interesting, and Republicans would do well to think about it. We lost the war in Vietnam by pulling out and ceding the country to the communist North Vietnamese. But Vietnam ultimately did exactly what Coulter derisively said would not happen. They're on friendly terms with us now, and they're moving as quickly as possible to a market-based economy. I wonder if the results would have been so good for U.S.-Vietnam relations, if the U.S. had put another few hundred thousand troops in, taken over the country, had the then Saigon government rule the country with us supporting them as a semi-occupier. I don't think they'd think quite as well of us now if that had happened. Back to Coulter's article. Coulter writes, Reagan quoted Mr. Democrat himself, Al Smith, for the proposition that the Democratic Party was no longer the party of Jefferson, Jackson, and Cleveland, but was now the party of Marx, Lenin, and Stalin. And that was 30 years before they tried to push Hillary care on us. Coulter goes on to say Reagan was a bulldog, completely implacably right-wing on every issue. He was the right-wing energizer bunny. He never quit, and he kept beating liberals. He cut taxes 25% across the board his first year in office. He walked away from Gorbachev at Reykjavik. He fired all those air traffic controllers and wouldn't let them come back even when they wanted to. He gave speeches about welfare queens and polluting trees. He nominated Antonin Scalia and Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. And he enraged grim liberals when he warmed up his radio mic by saying, my fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes. And Coulter closed with, because Reagan lived, the world is a better place. It's actually pretty sad that the world is a better place came so close after a joke about bombing Russia, but that's modern-day Republicans for you. Interestingly, Coulter not only proves my thesis, she also suggests that Reagan provided the genesis for the hostile and aggressive foreign policy we have seen from Republican presidents in particular over the past 30 years, but that's for another show. Coulter is, of course, by far, not the only Reagan follower who rants about liberals like this. There are dozens of them. I've mentioned a number of them here already. Michelle Malkin, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity. Reagan's own adopted son, Michael Reagan, took away some of the worst possible lessons from his father on discourse. Listen to what Michael Reagan had to say at a rally for Newt Gingrich around 6 to 8 months ago.
If you could think of the liberals, think of them as termites, eating away at the foundations of your home each and every day. See, that's what they do every day. See, we can't afford to let them keep doing that. We can't just go home and forget about it. And
that's what Michael Reagan listened to and learned from being around his father. I think it's hard to argue that Michael and the other conservative pundits that I mentioned got this anywhere else. Reagan is why things are the way they are today in America. He is why we have this fiscal cliff impasse that not only is going on now, but has played out in various forms over the past 2 years. Reagan is why Republicans trumped up a consensual sexual affair to impeach Bill Clinton. Reagan is why Republicans are trumping up Benghazi to go after Barack Obama. It all goes back to Reagan's public example of party over country, of demonizing liberals, of, as Coulter put it, forcing Americans to confront the real ideological divide between conservatives and, as Reagan put it, our liberal friends. Reagan's why an Ann Coulter exists. Reagan is why a Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Michelle Malkin and all the other hateful and divisive voices on the right exist. And he is why, sad to admit, many of us on the left, like me, have had to adjust our approach to become more confrontational in order to deal with them. So as I've described, Ronald Reagan did some real damage to America on a number of fronts, but I want to emphasize two of them here. First, Reagan is singularly responsible for destroying the ability of Republicans and Democrats to work together. I think I've made that clear. Second, Reagan changed the underlying type of government we have from a democratic republic to a de facto plutonomy. A 2004 article by Mark Ames in The Exile laid it out quite well in the opening paragraphs. Ames wrote, "When Ronald Reagan took power in 1981, Americans lived completely different lives. Healthcare insurance was a given for nearly all working Americans. Downsizing, the concept of mass layoffs in order to boost a CEO's bonus, hadn't entered the vocabulary. Neither had outsourcing. Working parents came home from work before sundown. They ate dinners with their families. Unions were strong, and industrialists felt a social responsibility to ensuring their workers' well-being. This was all reflected in the income differential. In 1979, the average CEO earned 30 times his average employee's wage. For some reason, no one wants to remember this part of the past because it's too depressing, and it speaks too obviously to the real decline in America." Ames went on to say, "Reagan came to office and told the plutocrats to take everything that they wanted. I mean everything. Today, CEOs make 571 times their average employee's wage. Today's male white-collar workers in America only earn in real dollars 6 cents per hour more today than they earned in 1973. Healthcare is increasingly hard to come by. No job is ever safe. Americans work far longer hours and suffer from stress-related illnesses once unheard of." Boy, did Mark Ames hit it on the head there. It's a total alternate reality that has come into existence in the United States following Ronald Reagan. It makes anybody who really cares about this country and the middle class and the poor sick to think about it. But regarding plutonomy, in 2005 and 2006, Citigroup management came out with two internal memos they thought would be kept private. They read in part, "We project that the plutonomies, speaking of the United States and several other countries, will likely see even more income inequality, disproportionately feeding off a further rise in the profit share in their economies, capitalist-friendly governments, more technology-driven productivity, and globalization. Citigroup's memos went on to say, in a plutonomy, there's no such animal as, quote, the American consumer or, quote, the UK consumer or, indeed, the Russian consumer. There are rich consumers, few in number, but disproportionate in the gigantic slice of income and the consumption that they take. There are the rest, the non-rich, the multitudinous many, but only accounting for surprisingly small bites of the national pie. Citigroup's memos go on to describe what the investing challenges are and risks in that type of an economy. And they finish with, secondly, if the rich are going to keep getting richer, as we think they will do, then this has ongoing positive implications for the businesses selling to the rich. We have called these businesses plutonomy stocks. We see three reasons to take another look at those plutonomy stocks. Citigroup has been pretty aggressive in trying to keep these memos off of the internet. Every time they're posted somewhere, the website owner gets a letter from Citigroup's lawyers telling them to take the memos down. But since Reagan, our economy has turned from one that was friendly to workers and middle-class families into one that benefits a smaller and smaller group of people who are getting richer and richer, while everyone else struggles to make ends meet and to take care of their families. Citigroup knows this, and I would bet most other financial and investment groups know this, and they are tailoring their investment strategies and targeting clients based on that reality. That is the legacy of Reaganomics and supply-side economics in action. Now, I realize I seem to have strayed a bit from my original thesis of Ann Coulter, liberalism, and Ronald Reagan's divisiveness, but let me pull it all together. We in America are suffering from a number of after effects from Reagan's administration. One is that there is a divisiveness in America that did not exist before. That divisiveness exists in both our political discourse, the inability of Democratic and Republican elected officials to work together, and we see that with the fiscal cliff discussions. It exists when ordinary Americans try to talk to each other, and it exists between the have and have-nots in society. Put succinctly, Ronald Reagan tore this country apart at the seams and set us against one another. His acolytes like Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and Michelle Malkin in media, and John Boehner, Mitch McConnell, John McCain, and various other elected Republicans are still actively working to do this. And Reagan, the great divider as I call him, is still worshipped as some sort of American hero in an unfortunately large segment of our country. I'm not particularly religious, but I wish Reagan, who claimed to be very religious and was a darling of the religious right, had remembered one particular biblical verse whose wisdom goes beyond ecclesiastical. That verse is from the New Testament, Matthew 12:25, and reads in part, "Every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and every city or house divided against itself will not stand." If you understand that statement and believe it for the wisdom that it is, what does it mean that Reagan, in basically the words of those who consider him a hero, set out to put a spotlight on and magnify the differences between conservatives and liberals? What does it mean that his acolytes like Coulter and Michelle Malkin and Hannity and Limbaugh and Boehner and McConnell are some of the most divisive people this country has ever seen? I'll tell you what it means to me. If a house divided cannot stand, and you are from that house and work to divide the house, aren't you in effect a traitor to that house? The worst part is, I don't know how to put things right. I know that if we Democrats don't fight fire with fire, we lose. It's the same issue as negative campaigning. Nobody likes it, but if your opponent doesn't and you don't, you lose because it works so well. What has to happen is that a large majority of the Republican caucus has to stop behaving this way. things like the trumped-up issue of Benghazi have to stop, and they actually have to be willing to compromise on a wide variety of issues, like the fiscal cliff. But neither seems likely. Just today, we hear that negotiations between the White House and congressional Republicans regarding the fiscal cliff have made no progress. They made no progress because Republicans are refusing to raise taxes on the rich. Before Reagan took office, the top tax bracket paid 70% of the top portion of their income in taxes. At their lowest point in Reagan's presidency, the highest tax bracket was down to 28%. President Obama is only proposing a change on the top tax bracket from 35% to 39.6%, where it was during Clinton's presidency. The difference is not that much, at least not relatively, but we can't get there. Why? Because the Republicans take away from Reagan is that Democrats are evil and that taxes should be kept low and to raise them is evil. So in the fight against two evils, Boehner and McConnell will not suffer any kind of backlash from their base of voters if they refuse to give in, no matter what the ultimate consequences are to America and the economy. For Republicans, and I've said this many times on my show, it's no longer about coming up with a solution to this country's problems. It's about fighting whom Reagan taught them is the enemy. Taxes, and more importantly, the Democrats. Now, I want to make sure people understand this. I don't think Reagan had any idea at all that this is what would result from his brand of Republican politics. He wasn't that much of a thinker. He liked to joke about and put down the, quote, elite thinkers in Washington. Reagan's world was much more simple. He had his moral absolute positions, and he had his personal relationships with people. I mean, judging from the anecdotes from Chris Matthews and other Democrats of the time, if Reagan had the opportunity to engage you one-on-one, you could see that the divisiveness that came across and the way he expressed certain things in public did not have malice behind it. Unfortunately, that attitude didn't make it to the masses of his supporters. They only saw his public cutting remarks about liberals being evil socialists and surrendering to whatever international foe he was railing about at the time. I don't think that Reagan even began to understand that he was leaving behind a mass of vitriolic supporters who would not be able to work with or really even coexist with Democrats after him. I think that would make him sad to see. But sad or not, that's what we have. And the question which I will leave unanswered, because I have no answer, is how do we fix it? This is the question that I will return to periodically on future shows, but unfortunately I'll have to leave it there for now. That's all I have for this evening. I thank you for tuning in. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at noon Eastern Time this Sunday, December 2nd. Until then, have a great evening, a great rest of the week, and a great start to your weekend.
Don't you know I'm still standing better than I ever did? Looking like a doo-doo.